are yours, regardless of the result of our conversation. Please, just give us 10 minutes to speak with you first. It is an absolute emergency. I told you I wasn't interested in anything you had to offer. 5 minutes, Rima implored. I beg of you. It's a matter of utmost importance. The American sighed, then looked at his watch. I'll give you 1 minute. If I am interested in the conversation, I'll give you another minute. If you are really fucking entertaining, I'll give you a 3rd minute. He motioned to the sofa in front of him. Then I'm gone for good. Rima spoke as she and her husband sat down.
That's just fine. Thank you.
The man said, "Your driver, is he coming up here after he parks?" Tarek nodded. "Does he want to catch a bullet in the eye?" Now Tarek winced.
"No, certainly not. We will tell him you are our guest. He will wait outside."
Now the asset motioned to a pair of large framed photographs on the wall across the room. They were portraits, one of a man, one of a woman, and they both appeared to be in their mid or late 20s.
"Children?"
Rima nodded.
"Any chance they will pop in on Mom and Dad while I'm here?"
Tarek answered brusquely.
"No. No chance at all."
The American in the chair said,
"All right. First make the transfer."
Tarek pulled his laptop from his bag and opened it, and within 3 minutes he had transferred the money into the account. While this was going on, Mustafa returned to the flat after parking the car and was surprised to see the stranger sitting with his principals. His left hand slipped inside his jacket, but Tarek held a hand up and assured the former Syrian soldier that everything was fine, and they sent him to wait in the hallway. The American confirmed the wire transfer with his smartphone, then looked up at the couple.
"The clock is ticking."
Rima had sat still and quiet during the transfer, but now she smiled at the stranger in her living room.
"What is your name, sir?"
The American chuckled now as he rolled his eyes.
"You guys are too much."
"I'm sorry," she said. "Is that not a question asked of men like you?"
"Call me whatever you want, Tarek, but you've got 45 seconds to do it."
Tarek spoke quickly.
"There has been a complication."
Another little eye roll.
"Sorry, folks, no refunds."
"You misunderstand. It is not a complication with you. You were magnificent, just as advertised. No, the problem is with Mademoiselle Medina."
The man in the chair reached for the pistol and scooped it off the table, startling both Syrians. Then he leaned forward and slid it into his waistband in the small of his back.
"You're losing me already. If I snatch the wrong lady, then it's the fault of whoever you've got acquiring your intel, not me."
"She was the right woman," Rima said.
The American cocked his head.
"So, she's not his mistress?"
Tarek answered now.
"She is, but she is also something else. Something we didn't know about when we sent you to rescue her."
He looked down at his hands and then back up. Rima leaned in.
"She is a mother. Her 4-month-old son is back in Syria."
The grandfather clock ticked off a few seconds more before the American just said,
"Oops."
"Her child is currently under the care of a nanny, guarded by security officers at her home in Damascus."
The American blew out a sigh, clearly understanding where the conversation was going.
"And this is the part where you tell me who the daddy is."
Tarek said,
"According to Mademoiselle Medina, Ahmed Azam is the father."
The visitor looked off into space now.
"That throws a wrench into the works, doesn't it?"
The Halabis struggled to understand the colloquialism, but Tarek responded,
"Azam is aware of this love child of his. In fact, he is the one protecting his son with members of his own security detail."
Now the American sat up straighter in the chair. Tarek could tell he was genuinely curious, which meant he likely had another minute to convince the man to help his cause. He asked,
"Protecting him from who?"
Rima answered,
"From his wife, Shakira Azam. She knew about the affair, of that we are certain. We do not know if she is aware of the child."
"So, your whole plan was to flip Bianca so she would give up Ahmed's plan against the Russians, hoping that might weaken the regime. But Medina left a baby back in Syria, a baby Ahmed has access to. She'd have to be a pretty shitty mother to turn on Azam now." Tarek nodded.
She refuses to help us. Needless to say, she wants to return to Damascus to be with her son. And, needless to say, we can't let her do that.
The American asset said, I hate to state the obvious, but you two don't know what the hell you are doing.
I'm not just talking about the fact that you were clueless to the compromises of your target, compromises that makes her worthless as an intelligence asset. I'm also talking about the stunt you just pulled, neglecting to pay a freelance asset because you wanted to talk to him. 2 times out of 3, that will get you killed in this game.
Your ploy to get me to listen to you work this time, but you try that next time with another contract asset, and he will shoot you at standoff distance and be done with it.
With your help, sir, Rima said, there won't be a next time, and there won't be another contract asset.
The American whistled softly.
Oh, I get it. You coaxed me here so you could ask me to go into Syria and kidnap the son of the president.
Tarek shook his head.
No, not a kidnapping. It would be a rescue mission.
Right. All I have to do is find a way to explain that to the bodyguards, the cops, the intelligence officials, and the military forces in my way. When neither Tarek nor Rima spoke, the man just leaned back in the chair.
You two are out of your damn minds. No fucking way you'll get me to go to Syria, Tarek said.
We can get you in, and we can get you out. We have people there who will help you.
Tarek.
3/4 of the shit that goes wrong in my life starts with some asshole feeding me that exact same line. He stood up to leave. Rima and Tarek stood as well, and Rima said,
Sir, I wouldn't ask you to go if I didn't believe you could do it. A Westerner can get in via a weekly charter flight carrying surgeons into the capital to work at Syrian regime hospitals. We can put you in with them, with all the documents you need to be safe. Our documents are good. Just look at yesterday, for example. We provided you with the intelligence and papers that you needed to succeed in your mission.
That's a lousy example, whether you know it or not. Either you are lying to me, or someone else is lying to you. Last night wasn't what it looked like. It was a setup.
A setup?
Rima was stunned. Someone in your organization purposefully sent me to that address at the same time ISIS was planning to make their attempt on Medina.
Ridiculous. But then she asked, why would someone working for us do that?
It's all about earning the trust and allegiance of the woman. If I snuck her away from her bodyguards, she might have been thankful, or she might still have looked at it like it was an abduction. But if I pulled her out of there in the middle of a terrorist attack, she would have been more appreciative, even more beholden to those who rescued her.
Rima said, but everyone in our organization who knows about this operation is committed to overthrowing Ahmed Azam. Sending you in when we knew the terrorists would attack only increases the chances you would be killed and fail, or Bianca would be killed, which means we all would fail.
The American had an answer to this. Someone in your organization knew my reputation. They knew I could succeed when others could not. Very few people know this, and nobody who did not know this would dare roll those dice. Tarek and Rima stole a glance at each other. The American said, and you both know exactly who I'm talking about. When neither of them spoke, he asked, who is he? The Frenchman I spoke with. Is he the one pulling your strings? There was more pained silence in the room until Tarek said,
I am sorry to put it this way, sir, but you are hired help. I am not giving you information about our organization, only what you need in order to do the job.
Court looked at the refined, middle-aged couple, and he could not see any hint at all that they ran a rebel group.
Why do you do this?
Rima looked at Tarek, then back at Court. Her eyes misted over.
We did not want war with Ahmed Azam. It was the young who thought it could be won. Those of us in the older generation, we told the young people, you don't know the Azam family. They will drown the nation in blood before they relinquish power. But the young would not listen. And now they are dead. All the dancing, the singing they did when the protests began, the pride of fighting for something they believed in, all those
beautiful young people, all those beautiful memories, all that hope is buried under the stone now. All that remains is Ahmed and Shakira Azam. They are smiling over the corpses of the rebellion.
Tarek added to his wife's thoughts.
Personally, I wish the rebellion would end. But you'll never hear me saying that publicly. Not because I support Azam. Just because I know he will kill every living thing that opposes him now.
Then why do you run a rebel movement?
Tarek answered for them both.
We have our reasons. Now, we have to do whatever we can to bring him down. And Bianca Medina is the key.
Court said. You act like you are in control of what's going on.
You two are just puppets.
And with that, he headed past them towards the entryway. He put his hand on the door latch. He was steps away from disappearing again.
Rima said, If you leave, what will happen with the war in Syria?
I didn't start it and I sure as hell can't end it.
He looked back and forth between the two of them.
Look, like you said, I'm just the hired gun here. But I can see the problem with your entire op. Your reach exceeded your grasp. If you flipped Bianca, you might have been able to get Azam in hot water with the Russians. But this plan of yours wasn't ever going to lead to his ouster. This was a harassing action, nothing more.
He shrugged.
You tried, and you failed.
He opened the door now, looked out into the hall, but turned back before departing.
What will you do with Bianca?
Rima said,
That is no concern of yours, clearly. You are leaving her and us behind.
The man said nothing, but neither did he make any move to walk through the door.
Tarek heaved his chest. She will be taken care of here. She will not be harmed. But we can't let her return to Syria. She knows too much about us and our organization now.
The asset looked at the floor now.
The kid? What will happen to the baby when his mom doesn't come back?
To this, Tarek said,
Ahmed has never acknowledged the son's existence, so anything could happen. But if he has any decency, then I suppose...
The American looked up. Jesus Christ. Do you realize what you just said?
Tarek stared blankly at the man at the door.
The baby will not survive long. If Azam thinks Bianca is dead, he won't bring the child into the palace. Shakira would not stand for it. Azam will be looking for Bianca now. But when he does not find her, he will have to remove the compromise.
Tarek frowned.
Kill the child, most likely. But you can't expect us to just send Bianca home to Azam after what she knows. We must keep her here and try to persuade her to help us.
The American did nothing to hide the disdain from his face. He just turned into the hall. Mustafa pushed off from where he was leaning against the wall and looked at the Western stranger.
Rima called out from behind. We know we aren't in control of all this. We aren't trained as revolutionaries.
No shit. Snapped the American.
We are doctors, she continued. And we are desperate for our people back in Syria, for the future of our nation. We thought this was a perfect opportunity to find important information about Azam that could be used against him to end the war. It was?
Rima's eyes teared.
We just didn't know about the baby.
The American said,
You are playing a dangerous game you don't understand. Please, take my advice. Free the girl, and then go back to aid and comfort. Something you're good at.
And with that, he left the couple alone in their second floor apartment, pushing past Mustafa in the narrow hallway. Chapter 15 Court walked down the long hallway towards the stairwell. He descended one flight, moved through a narrow and dark passageway to the door to the street, then stepped out onto the Rue Mazarin. A pair of motorcycle cops wearing the uniform of public order and traffic control rolled in his direction from the north, slowing to a stop not far from the Halabi's large apartment building. They showed no interest in him, and there were 24 other pedestrians around, so Court simply turned to the south,
then made a quick right on a small winding avenue with outdoor cafes on both sides of the street. The two helmeted cops never saw him. Court's personal security was at the forefront of his thinking now. All the pedestrians around him, the people he could see through the shop windows, in the vehicles passing by, they all had to be assessed as a potential threat. His eyes scanned and his brain spun as he evaluated individuals looking for pre-assault indicators, the flash of a camera lens striking sunlight, any odd mannerisms that could indicate someone taking interest in his presence. And cops. Court always had an eye open for cops, but especially in Paris, because he had something of a history here. He'd been to Paris more than 24 times in his life, which meant he knew these streets, and that helped him both assimilate and keep a keen eye for anyone acting out of phase. He spoke the language, and he had the feel and rhythm of the city down cold. Not all of his experiences had been good. He'd nearly been stabbed to death just a few blocks south of here a couple of years earlier, in an alleyway that ran off the Rue de la Sainte-Comédie. And then he nearly bled out along the left bank of the Seine just a few blocks to the north. But despite his close calls, he was comfortable here in the French capital. His tradecraft normally kept him safe, and he had every confidence it would do so today, at least long enough for him to get out of town. And getting out of town was on his mind now. He told himself he had to go someplace far away from the neophytes who had hired him into this sloppy train wreck of an operation. But as he walked, he couldn't help but feel something tugging at him. Something telling him he shouldn't leave the Halabis to swing in the wind alone. He had no doubt they'd be killed before this was all over. There was danger in Paris, even from threats born out of Syria. The Halabis were running the group holding the Syrian president's mistress, and that would send a lot more bad actors into the area sooner and not later. Azam would either want her back or he'd want to silence her. Either way, people would die. Court knew he had no business in the middle of that madness, but he still felt like shit about leaving a lot of nearly defenseless people to deal with the fallout. The naive and foolish young mother, the middle-aged couple working for the peace and health of their people, only to find themselves at the heart of a high-stakes life-and-death operation. And a 4-month-old child, son to the devil incarnate, true, but a baby, whose only crime was having a shitty dad. It was a cruel, sick, heartless world. This, Court told himself, not for the first time, and as he turned onto the Rue Saint-André des Arts, his eyes still wary for threats, his mind began wondering just why he gave a damn about some random baby in some faraway land. 24 hours ago, he was trying to keep his head in the game because of his feelings for a woman on the other side of the world he might never see again. And now, he found himself on the verge of getting caught up in a multi-faction civil war in the Middle East. A quagmire that looked more and more like a never-ending meat grinder. Why the hell did he even care? It didn't take him long to come up with the answer. Even though nothing that had gone wrong for the Halabis in the past 24 hours was, in any way, his fault, Court knew that his own actions now would determine if these people lived or died. And it wasn't impossible to imagine that getting that child in Damascus to safety could also play a small, but important part, in bringing one of the most brutal dictatorships on Earth to a close. Court sure as hell didn't want to go to Syria, but he weighed it against the alternative, sitting around in some European cafe, sipping coffee, with the knowledge that right then, a baby was being hunted, a mother was helpless 2,500 miles away from her son, a well-meaning husband and wife were in imminent peril of assassination, and a savage dictator was winning his war. Court's moral compass was trying to steer his body to get involved, but his brain was fighting back, because Court's brain had long ago concluded that this moral compass of his was an unrelenting pain in the ass. "No," he said aloud. "No fucking way." Just then, Court's attention cycled back to the present. His per-sec radar pinged when he saw another pair of motorcycle cops pull to a stop on the Rue André Mazet, blocking the narrow road. But just as quickly as he alerted to them, the two young officers pushed their bikes up on the pavement and took their time removing their helmets. They showed no interest in Court as he approached their position across the little street, and as he passed them, he saw no hint of trouble. As he stepped by the pair, the radio on one man's shoulder chirped. A voice asked the officer where he was, and the bike cop relayed the street corner. Court thought little of this, until the voice on the radio ordered the two bike officers to maintain their positions until further notice. Court kept walking, but he understood now that this duo was holding some sort of a soft perimeter right in the center of Paris. They were clearly waiting for someone or something. Neither of the young cops looked in any way anxious. Court thought they might have been set up for a passing march or something similar. But he thought back to the other pair of cops he saw. They had been pulling up right in front of the Halabi's apartment building. Were they part of this perimeter as well? Or were the Halabis at the center of this police action? Court turned left, and then he stepped into a restaurant crowded with lunchtime diners, picked his way through the throngs of business people and tourists, and continued walking all the way to the rear of the establishment. Something told him to double back to the Halabi's apartment building to check on them just on the chance the police were there, arresting the couple for their involvement in the action the night before. For their own good, Court realized, the best thing that could happen to Rima and Tariq would be to get picked up by the cops for questioning. Their life expectancy would go up surrounded by locks and bars, because the clock was sure as hell ticking on their survival out here in the wild. Court told himself he'd feel better about this whole thing if they were arrested and confessed to snatching Bianca Medina, and the Spanish woman was released to go home to her child. He just wanted to see if this was, in fact, what was going on. He pushed through the back of the restaurant, turned left in a tiny alleyway, then made it out on the street a half block beyond where the two motorcycle cops on the Rue de Bussy could see him. He was just two short blocks from the Halabi's building now, and his only plan was to be a spectator if the cops had come calling on Tariq and Rima. Court arrived back on the Rue Mazarine, a half block south and across the street from the building, and now he saw a total of four motorcycle police officers from Public Order and Traffic Control, all parked in front of the door to the apartment. He turned to his left and kept walking, keeping his eyes on the action but affecting the cadence and bearing of just another lunchtime pedestrian. So, the Halabis got themselves flagged by the local police. He wasn't surprised, and he wasn't feeling especially guilty about it. He knew that nothing he had done at the scene the evening before had anything to do with them being tied to the event at 7 Rue Tronchet. No, one of their surveillance guys talked, or one of their men holding Bianca got cold feet and dropped the dime on them. Court wondered what this meant for Medina, and for the baby. Perhaps when Bianca was released, she'd race back to Syria, into Ahmed's arms, and all would be quickly forgotten. A four-door Renault Megane pulled up in front of the house, and two men climbed out. Court recognized the emblem of the DRPJ on the door of the vehicle, the Direction Régionale de Police Judiciaire de Paris. These were Paris criminal police, local investigators. They pulled badge lanyards from their shirts and waved them at the four motorcycle officers. The four uniformed and helmeted men stepped to the side. A glass door was opened with a code entered into a keypad on the wall, and the two detectives headed inside. Suddenly, Court realized he'd seen these two detectives before. These were the men who'd been hanging around outside 7 Rue Tronchet on civilian motorcycles, and they'd taken off not long after Bianca was dropped off at her hotel. At the time, Court wondered if they had been involved in surveillance on Bianca Medina. But since they left within minutes of her arrival, he'd pushed his concerns aside. But seeing them again here now was confusing to him. Court turned into the doorway of a small grocery store and entered. Here, he immediately began pretending to look over a display of wine by the front window, giving him a covert vantage point on the building across the street. Something was very wrong about this situation. These plainclothes guys were investigators for the Paris Police Prefecture, and this didn't make sense to Court. Of course, there were 20 apartments in the building, and these guys could have been conducting an investigation at any one of them. But this was the 6th arrondissement. Surely, there were 100 crimes going on in Paris right now, but the 6th arrondissement was about the least likely of any of the 20 in the city to see this kind of action. No. A half dozen police on the scene of the exact building where the couple at the center of a high-profile kidnapping the night before lived. Court wasn't one to believe in coincidence. These cops were definitely here for the Halabis. But if the authorities thought there was one chance in 100 that Bianca Medina was being held here, or if they thought the people involved with her abduction were right here in the city center in an upper-class apartment building, surely they wouldn't have just parked bike cops from public order and traffic control out front and sent a pair of local detectives upstairs for a chat. No, terrorism was a federal crime here in France. Federal investigators would have brought tactical officers with armored assault vehicles, and they would have hit this building hard. This whole thing looked fishy as hell, and Court suddenly had a bad feeling about what was going on in front of him. He stood there in the grocery store across the street, watching the four motorcycle cops standing at the front door, talking to one another. They had been ordered there, obviously, but they weren't on any sort of anti-terror mission. The cops carried Sig Pro 9mm pistols, telescoping batons, and mace on their belts, and they were four fit enough men, but these dudes were just window dressing. They'd been planted here by the two cops who'd gone upstairs. The same two guys who'd conducted recon out in front of the Rue Tronchet a few hours before the ISIS attack yesterday. Court made a judgment quickly, using all the evidence before him. Those two cops were dirty. Working for the interests of Ahmed or Shakira Azam was his best guess. He told himself he could not stand here across the street while the Halabis were detained or assassinated by Azam's proxies. He had to stop them, and to do this he needed to get past the bike cops. He could take another route into the building, but that would take time. He'd gained access via the roof of an adjoining building earlier in the day, and there were second-floor windows that he could possibly scale up to. But whatever the hell was going on over there was going on right now. And if they were planning on bundling the Halabis up to take them to a secondary location, then at least six armed men would be out in the street at the same time when the couple came out the door. For all Court knew, a paddy wagon was en route, or another dozen motorcycle cops would be here any minute. Court wasn't going to shoot it out with French cops, most of whom would be completely innocent. Shit, 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 Court thought. He looked up and down the street, trying to decide what to do. Part of him wished he'd just kept walking 5 minutes earlier, but part of him knew this was exactly why he had come back to check on the situation. If the Halabis had one shot in hell, that shot was the Gray Man. He blew out a long sigh, looked up and down the narrow winding street, and realized he was probably about to beat the shit out of four innocent policemen who hadn't done anything wrong. Chapter 16. The gentle knock on the door of the Halabi's apartment came as Mustafa was dealing with the whistling tea kettle in the kitchen, so only Rima heard it at first. She was alone in the living room, with Tarek back in the master bedroom, changing out of the clothes he'd been wearing for the last 30 hours. When she heard the rapping, she immediately thought of her upstairs neighbor, Mrs. Rousseau, who often called unannounced. Perhaps she'd heard the talking and had come to see if she could pick up any gossip as to the identity of the Halabi's English-speaking visitor. Rima went to the door and looked through the peephole, and was surprised to see a police badge being held up by a clean-shaven man in his 30s. Behind him, a bald man had a badge of his own hanging from a lanyard around his neck. The man closest to the door clearly saw someone looking through the hole, because he said,
"Monsieur and Madame, Dr. Halabi, I am Lieutenant Michael Allard of the PJ. I have intern Lieutenant Anton Fons with me. Open the door so we can speak for a moment, s'il vous plaît."
Rima knew the police judiciaire were local criminal investigators. She also knew this was not good. But she saw no way to avoid a conversation. She turned to the kitchen and whispered to Mustafa, telling him to hide the pistol he kept inside his jacket. But she had no idea if he heard her. Unsure, she left the chain on the door, but unlocked it. The idea was to talk to the men, to make some noise doing so, and to buy some time.
"Bonjour, monsieur. How can I help you?"
Lieutenant Allard smiled.
"Comme ça?" Like this.
Without hesitation, he brought his leg up and kicked hard against the door, breaking the chain and knocking Rima back 2 meters into the entryway. The second man rushed past the first. Rima saw a black gun with a long silencer in his hand. And as they moved into the living room, the bald man shouldered into Rima as he passed, knocking her back several meters more. Lieutenant Allard kicked the door shut as he entered, then raced across the entryway, took a stunned Rima by the arm and pulled her deeper into the apartment. Mustafa spun into the living room from the kitchen with his pistol just coming out of his jacket, a look of alarm on his face. The bald Parisian police officer was only 3 steps away, and he was raising his own weapon. Both men were committed to action. Their proximity and mutual surprise meant there was no opportunity for de-escalation. Foss fired before his silencer was level with the Syrian's chest, hitting the Syrian in the shin and causing him to jerk his body in reaction to the pain and noise. A second loud snap came from the cop's gun as a round hit Mustafa in the stomach, and a third caught him in the top of the head as he fell forward, face first onto the floor. Expended cartridges from Foss's SIG bounced around the room. Blood drained freely from the dead man's skull, creating a halo in red on the brown tile flooring. Lieutenant Allard pushed Rima hard, deeper into the living room, shoving her onto the sofa she'd been sitting on minutes earlier while talking to the American. Allard's own gun was out, but it wasn't pointed at Rima. Instead, it was pointed at the hallway leading to the rest of the apartment. Dr. Tara Kalabi raced out of the hall, straight into the line of fire. He wore his undershirt and his suit pants, and he pulled up immediately, raised his empty hands and stood there, looking down to his wife, who lay on the sofa on Tarek's right.
"No," he shouted. "Don't hurt her. We'll give you whatever you want."
Lieutenant Allard lowered his weapon, then twitched it towards Rima, motioning for Tarek to join his wife. The second police officer stepped over to Mustafa, picked up his gun, and slipped it into the small of his back. Allard now pointed with his free hand to the dead body in the kitchen doorway with the halo of blood around the head.
"That man, I'm sure we will find, had no license to carry a firearm in France. We had no alternative but to shoot him."
Tarek and Rima just stared back at him. Tarek asked,
"What do you want?"
Allard pulled a chair out of the seating area, spun it around, and sat down on it backwards.
"We want Bianca Medina. And before you tell me that you don't know who or what I am talking about, you need to understand one thing. We arrested Ali Safra, your underling at the Free Syria Exile Union. He informed us about his surveillance of Bianca. We also have a video of her being led away from her hotel last night by a man, obviously hired by you. You have broken dozens of French laws in your kidnapping operation, and you both could spend the rest of your lives in prison for your actions. But we would be willing to work with you on the charges if you tell us where Medina is being held."
Tarek said,
"Only 2 of you? You think we have kidnapped a woman at gunpoint, killed 5 bodyguards, and at least as many terrorists? And you and your colleague here are the only ones to come look into the matter? Do you take us for fools?"
Rima's voice cracked when she spoke.
"You are not policemen. You are agents of Ahmed Azam."
The Frenchman made a face of disgust at the name.
"I assure you my badge is legitimate. I am merely here making an inquiry."
Allard pulled his badge lanyard from around his neck and tossed it to Tarek, now sitting on the couch next to his wife.
"Trust me, monsieur. I have more officers at the front door and several more holding a perimeter around the neighborhood. And inspect my badge if you must. Ask yourself, if I were not a real policeman, why would I keep up the ruse? Why wouldn't I just shoot you in the knee or your wife in the forehead and force you to give me information?"
Tarek looked at the badge, then up at the man standing over him and his wife. The second man was closer to the kitchen, his pistol low in his hand.
"I know people at PJ. Let me contact them. See if you are who you say you are."
Allard chuckled.
"You are in no position to make counter demands." "Then we will say nothing until you take us to the 36,
Tarek said. The massive headquarters of the PJ was at the famous address of 36 Quai des Orfèvres, and Parisians referred to the building simply as the 36. Allard shrugged.
"We could go to the station, but time is of the essence. The life of the Spanish national who has taken last evening is all we care about."
Tarek repeated himself.
"We will say nothing until we are at the station."
The Frenchman did not move a muscle for nearly 10 seconds. Then he slowly smiled and shook his head.
No. I think we will do this right here.
He pulled out his phone, dialed a number, and actuated the speaker function. Court stepped out of the grocery store and walked purposefully across the street and directly towards the four police officers. The door to the Halabi's apartment building had been propped open with a planter by one of the policemen, and Court hoped like hell the four men standing there would let him enter unchecked. But he had no such luck. As soon as it became apparent where he was going, one of the men spoke to him in French, asking if he lived in the building. Court stopped 10 feet from the door, in front of the four officers.
Sorry, do you speak English?
One of the other officers took over.
Do you live here?
Yes. What's going on?
Investigation upstairs. What is your flat number?
Court couldn't see the address cards on the wall by the entryway, but he'd been inside before. He'd gotten a handle on the organization of the building.
502, he smiled. Hope it's not me you're investigating.
The cop shook his head.
301. Still, you'll need to remain outside,
only for a few minutes.
Court knew the Halabis lived in 102, but he didn't believe they were off the hook in this. No. These guys down here had been given the wrong apartment number by the shady cops upstairs to disguise their real operation. Court ignored the cop's request and continued up to the door by stepping between the policemen. But he kept smiling. The English-speaking cop spoke louder now.
Hey, can you hear?
Now there were two men on each side of him, all on the street or on the narrow sidewalk. Court's hand was extended towards the propped open door, still 8 feet away. He kept moving and took another step on the sidewalk until the closest motorcycle cop reached out with a hand and put it on Court's right bicep to stop him. And that was all Court needed. He locked the cop's grasp down on his arm with his left hand, then spun hard to the right, taking the young man by surprise, yanking him off balance, and sending him stumbling helmet first into his motorcycle. Behind him, Court heard the snap of a telescoping baton firing out to its full length, and in front of him, Court saw a second officer reaching for his baton, an instant away from bringing the steel shaft into the fight. Court spun around and charged. He took the wrist of the first officer who had his baton out and controlled the weapon with his left hand. The other officer flicked his own baton, telescoping it into a 2-foot-long pipe that he moved to swing at Court's forehead, but Court yanked the baton arm of the man in front of him forward and used this man's weapon to block the strike from the second officer. After the blow bounced off, Court stripped the weapon in the hand he held by twisting it hard and down, and he body-checked the man over the top of the same motorcycle the first man had crashed into. Pedestrians on the Rue Mazarine all around shouted and screamed in alarm. The fourth cop snapped open his baton with one hand while he keyed the radio on his shoulder with his other, preparing either to call in reinforcements or to alert the pair upstairs. But Court swung his baton and smashed the radio and the officer's hand, sending the man to the ground, clutching his wounded fingers. Two cops swung at him nearly simultaneously with their blunt weapons. He blocked the first blow, then jabbed the butt of his baton forward, striking the attacker in the mouth and knocking him backwards. As soon as his hit was achieved, he moved his body low and into the man swinging from behind, closing the distance and halving the efficiency of the man's blow. Court took his weak baton strike off his shoulder, absorbing the pain to process it later, and he swept around the man's backswing with his right hand, bringing his baton around and slamming it hard into the officer's helmet at the left temple. The first man who'd fallen was back up. He readied his own baton, but Court targeted his hand, picked it up with his own, and closed his body into the threat. Their batons both swung and struck each other, first low, then high, over their heads. The second officer Court struck was now pulling himself up to a standing position with the aid of his motorcycle, and Court saw him reaching for his pistol. Court looked back to his present adversary, and on his next swing, Court caught the inside of the man's elbow with his hand and did something no cop was trained to defend against in baton class. Court let go of his baton, fired his hand straight forward at the officer's face, and rammed his fingers under the cop's sunglasses and into his eyes. The man dropped with a shout. His eyes would be bruised and burning and swollen. He'd be out of the fight for the rest of the day, if not the week. But Court hadn't done to this man a tenth of what this man was trying to do to him. As the cop fell, he released his baton. Court grabbed it by the telescope end, swung it in a full power 180-degree arc, and cracked the handle of the weapon against the slide of the SIG handgun that had been rising behind him. The pistol flew from the officer's hand, spun through the air across the street, and clanged along the sidewalk there. This man realized he didn't have a gun or a baton now, so he charged in desperation, but Court sidestepped him, took him in a headlock, and reached down to the man's utility belt. He pulled off the can of chemical spray attached there, thumbed open the safety tab, and shoved the man away. As the uniformed officer spun back around to face his attacker, Court fired the thick gel across the man's face, sending him to his knees, screaming, clawing at the chemical irritant in his eyes. All four officers lay in the narrow street now. Two were unconscious, one rolled around grabbing at his face, and the fourth moaned in the fetal position, clutching his broken fingers. And around the scene, 20 or so passers-by, men and women of all ages, stood and stared in disbelief at what they'd just witnessed. Court now pulled his own pistol from his belt and held it over his head. In French, he said, "Anybody who points a camera at me is getting shot." No one reached for their camera phones. Court ran to the door of the apartment building and moved the planter, holding it open as he entered. He pulled an item that looked like a silver key from his pocket and pushed the device into the deadbolt lock on the outside. The item was an instrument used to slow down any pursuers, a generic metal key that fit in most any lock. But where the bow met the shaft of the little instrument, the metal had been filed down. Court snapped off the bow, leaving the shaft all the way in the lock and making it difficult, if not impossible, to open the door without either removing the lock or carefully digging in and picking out the metal of the shaft with a pair of needle-nose pliers. He pulled the door closed, the lock engaged, and Court knew he'd removed this door as an entry point for the police, at least for the time being. Still, there was a side entrance to the building on a pedestrian passage on the north side, so he knew he had to hurry to both stop the dirty cops from kidnapping or killing the Halabis and avoid getting gunned down by furious police reinforcements. While the fight raged downstairs, in the Halabi's apartment, a man's voice came over the speakerphone.
"Hello?"
Allard placed the phone down on the coffee table in front of him and said,
"Monsieur Eric, I have them here. You are on the speaker."
A man spoke in French.
"Bonjour, Dr. Zalabi. My name is Eric, and it is a pleasure to speak with you, even if we must just do it over the mobile phone."
The Halabis did not respond.
"I'll cut to the chase. We are in a predicament, and you can help us."
Who are you?"
"I work for a party with an interest in locating Bianca Medina. It is our understanding that she is in your care, and I must tell you, I will do whatever it takes to achieve my objective."
Tarek said,
"We will tell you nothing."
"We? How wonderful to hear your harmony and cohesion with your spouse. But you see, Tarek, the truth is, I only need one of you alive to tell me where Medina has been taken. Lieutenant Allard, will you do me a favor and put the barrel of your pistol against Rima's head?"
Allard looked at the phone, and then at Foss. Slowly, he lifted his weapon and followed the instructions of the voice on the phone. When the weapon was flush with Rima's forehead, the middle-aged Syrian woman shut her eyes, and tears dripped out.
"Please!"
Tarek said. Just then, the radio in Allard's back pocket chirped. A broken transmission came through, first of a man coughing, then words.
"Lieutenant! This is Belin, downstairs. An armed man is inside the building."
The two police officers in the Halabi's apartment looked at each other, and then they spun their heads to the door. Into his walkie-talkie, Allard said,
"Who is he, and why the fuck did you let him in?"
"He... I don't know who he is, and we do not let him do anything.
Get up here now,"
Allard ordered.
We are all wounded. We've called for backup."
"Shit,"
Allard said. Eric spoke up now over the mobile phone.
"What's going on?"
The policemen ignored him. They were focused on this new danger. Allard put down the radio because he could hear someone sprinting up the hallway outside. Chapter 17 Court raced up the creaky wooden floored second-story hallway, closing on a right turn that led to the door to the Halabi's apartment. His right shoulder was sore from the blow he took from the baton in the street, even more so now because his suppressed Glock 19 was in his right hand and out in front of him, causing the muscles in his rear deltoid to flex right where he'd been hit by the weapon. On his left as he ran was a row of windows that looked down on the Passage Dauphine, a cobblestone pedestrian alley that led back to the east, away from the front of the building. The windows went down the length of the hall. The last one was right there at the turn, and Court knew that just beyond that was a window into the Halabi's living room, on the other side of the wall ahead of him. And this gave him an idea. He continued running forward with his weapon raised in front of him, carefully aimed it high on the wall between the hall and the Halabi's apartment, and pressed his finger against the trigger. Allard and Foss listened to the sound of the approaching runner and kept their pistols trained on the door, but as the footsteps neared the turn in the hallway ahead and to the right on the far side of the wall of the living room, the footsteps were replaced by the snaps of gunfire. Holes appeared high in the wall ahead of them. A framed painting fell to the ground and crashed, and the two men dove to the floor.
"Who's shooting?"
called out the man they knew as Eric on the speakerphone, but neither man was interested in providing a running commentary of what was going on. They heard the crash of broken glass an instant later. They tried to train their weapons on the origin of the sound, somewhere on the other side of the wall. But just as their focus turned back to the door, a much louder explosion of glass on their right grabbed their attention. A figure came crashing through the living room window, fewer than 10 meters from where they knelt. A man fell to the floor and rolled in front of the television, shattered glass still flying through the air all around him. Both cops swiveled their aim to the movement across the room, but the man rolling up into a crouch by the TV fired first. Foss's head snapped back before he could sight on the target, and his weapon spilled from his hand. Allard got a shot off, high and off the right shoulder of the figure. And as he made to squeeze his trigger again, he just had slight recognition of a flash of light emanating from the silencer of the man's pistol before his world went black. Court rose to his feet, crossed the living room, and fired an additional round into the heads of both men. Rima Halabi screamed in shock at the sight of even more blood splattering across her living room. He trained his weapon on the Halabis quickly, and Rima covered her eyes. Now he spun his weapon towards the dead Syrian security man in the doorway to the kitchen, then swiveled it down the hallway to the back of the apartment. Still covering the unknown space down the hall, Court shouted at the couple.
"Anyone else?"
"No," Tarek said. "No one."
Court lowered his pistol.
"Are you hurt?"
Tarek checked on his wife. She was sobbing in near panic, but he felt over her body and then checked himself out. Neither of them appeared to be bleeding.
I think we're okay."
Court jerked his head towards the two dead cops.
"They were working for the Syrians."
"We know,"
Tarek replied, staring at the three dead bodies on the floor of his apartment. Next to him, Rima brought her hands from her eyes. She was still sobbing, but Court could see that she'd handled the terror and chaos of the past few moments better than most, be they male or female. Court holstered his weapon in his waistband, ignored the hot suppressor touching his thigh, then helped the couple up to their feet.
"Listen to me carefully."
"Wait,"
Tarek said. He looked down at the phone on the table and pointed to it. Court looked at it, picked it up, and saw that there was an active call. He put his finger over the microphone.
"Who the hell is this?"
"A man's voice," Rima said. "He said he is working for someone trying to find Bianca. He sent these men."
Court still had the mic covered when the voice spoke.
"From the sound of things, I might need to hire some new men in Paris."
Court nodded to Tarek. The doctor leaned closer to the phone.
"Your men are dead. You will never find Bianca now. Your new guest, the American, is he too shy to talk?"
It was silent in the room for seconds, except for the sound of police sirens coming outside the broken window.
"Who are you?"
Court finally said. The man on the other end of the line replied.
"Who are you? Of course, I can work out on my own that you are the mystery man who abducted Bianca last night, but beyond that, I admit that I'm at a loss."
Court studied the man's voice. Court thought French was probably this man's native tongue, so he suspected he too might be a local police officer, just like the dead men on the floor. Rima Halabi was still panic-stricken, but she was a strong woman, and it was clear to Court she knew the importance of this moment. She shouted into the phone.
You are working for a monster! A man who has ordered the wholesale genocide of my people!
He is fighting a rebellion, the voice replied calmly. But I'm not going to get into a political discussion with you. It sounds to me like you all need to get out of there before the police arrive. Frankly, I hope you make it.
You are helping us now?
Tarek asked. Court answered for the man on the phone. He can't get his hands on you if you're locked up.
Smart man, the voice said. Mr. American, why don't you take this phone so you and I can discuss this further when you are somewhere safe from the police?
Court replied. Sure, asshole. Why don't I stick this tracking device in my pocket? Why don't you go fuck yourself? There was a short, perfunctory chuckle.
Very well. But know this. Whoever you are, your involvement has ensured that a lot of people are going to die. Including the Halabis, including yourself. I have more men in France, and they will be seeing you soon. I have a funny feeling you and I have not heard the last from each other.
You can count on that. Court hung up the phone, then wiped off the keypad. As soon as he did so, Tarek said,
He claimed his name was Eric, and he didn't say it, but he is definitely Swiss.
How do you know that? Asked Court.
Rima answered, We were speaking in French with him before you arrived. The word for mobile phone in France is portable, but he said Natal. Only the Swiss call a mobile a Natal.
Court wondered why a Swiss would be involved in this, but he didn't have any time to think it over. He said, 50 cops are going to be flooding through this building in a few seconds, but the police downstairs think the detectives were going up to the third floor. You need to leave now, out the side door, and just keep on going.
Rima nodded.
Okay. Just let me pack some.
No packing, just go. March right through the cops, they aren't looking for you.
But, Tarek said, they'll find the bodies in our flat.
At which point the police will start looking for you. You'll be able to prove these two cops were working for Syrian interests, that this was an assassination attempt, and then you will be in the clear, but for now, you'll have to run. The couple stood and put on their overcoats as they headed for the front door.
Thank you,
Rima muttered, but in her hurry and shock, she didn't even look Court's way.
Wait, Court said. You have to do one thing for me now.
Tarek turned back to him.
What is that?
Court told him what he needed. Tarek Halabi complied, and then the Halabis left their apartment, heading for the elevator and the side exit. The sounds of sirens echoed off every building in the left bank now. The police were already covering the front and back streets, but Court just closed and locked the apartment door, then headed back to the smashed window, leaving all the bodies as they were. Climbing through the window, he looked down towards the Passage Dauphine and saw a pair of cops standing at the side door, almost directly under Court's position. They weren't looking up, so Court swung out silently and moved along from window ledge to window ledge. Once he was out of view of their position, he descended via a drainpipe and ran off to the east, ducking into a travel agency for a brochure as a cavalcade of police cars rolled by.
Chapter 18. Sebastian Drexler sat in his office thinking over his conversation with the Halabis and this mysterious American working for them. He'd told the man he expected they would have more dealings with one another, and he fully anticipated this to be the case. He hoped he'd see him at the end of a gun barrel, and on the streets of Paris, for two reasons. One, Drexler saw himself as more than capable in a fight. And taking down this American who was making so much trouble for his operation would be supremely satisfying. And two, more than anything on this earth, Sebastian Drexler wanted to go home to Europe. Here in Damascus he had money, power, women, and respect. But he dreamed of seeing his home continent again, of being around Westerners and Western food, customs, and ideals. But he knew he had to be careful in Europe. Because if the police in any nation on the continent picked him up, he'd never set foot outside a prison as long as he lived. Drexler was born in the picturesque Swiss mountain village of Lauterbrunnen to parents who owned a climbing expedition tour company, and he became a top-ranked youth alpinist before leaving the nation of his birth for university. Educated in international relations at the London School of Economics and Political Science, he then spent a few years in his nation's foreign intelligence service. But the slow pace of Switzerland bored him. So he left his home country and took a job for a private risk management firm specializing in helping large corporations navigate their business interests in dangerous African conflict zones. Drexler was bright, cunning, ruthless when he needed to be, and ambitious. After a couple of years working for multinationals, he went out on his own, peddling his expertise as a veteran intelligence operative with third world experience to well-heeled African warlords. He spent 2 years working under Gaddafi, but got out before the fall of Libya. Then he spent 2 more years in Europe doing the remote bidding of Nigeria's corrupt leader Julius Abubakar. And then he did stints supporting the aims of the leadership in Egypt under Mubarak, in Zimbabwe under Mugabe, and in Sudan under Bakri Alaa-Abud. He was a field man who could think, not a mindless gunman, but a well-versed and broadly trained operative. He could protect, he could investigate, he could surveil his client's opposition and assess his client's threats. And yes, he could assassinate. Hell, Sebastian Drexler could raise armies and sack nations. But he grew tired of the Third World and sought employment back on his home continent. It took Sebastian Drexler years to make his way back to Europe, but finally he left Africa and was discreetly hired by one of the oldest family-owned banks on Earth, Meyer Privatbank of Gstaad. The institution employed him as a consultant for ultra-affluent private clients, assigning him to those who needed Drexler's discreet physical and mental abilities to help keep their funds right where they belonged, at Meyer Privatbank. He broke up family squabbles that threatened accounts with all manner of subterfuge and silenced his clients' legal problems with intrigue and violence. In rural Denmark, a wealthy family patriarch with cancer decided he wanted to remove all his holdings at Meyer, some 30 million euros, and donate them to medical research. The younger members of the family were livid, but legally, there was nothing they could do. The children consulted the bank. Sebastian Drexler arrived at the family estate outside Silkeborg and poisoned the patriarch to death with tainted meds before he could complete the transaction. The patriarch's kids were pleased, as were Drexler's employers at Meyer. Drexler did not have a conscience, he had a code. He served the wishes of his employer without question or hesitation. He would cheat, intimidate, maim, kill. He would fund an insurgent attack on a factory in Morocco, contract and sanction a street criminal to stab a lawyer over his wallet in Athens to get him off a case, do anything that would further the wishes of his bank's clients to keep his bank's balance sheet large and risks to his clients' assets small. Life was going well for Drexler, but eventually, his crimes caught up with him. Interpol identified him as a criminal and a killer for his actions in Africa, the Middle East, and Europe, and they began investigating his rumored ties to the Swiss banking industry. His employers could have washed their hands of him, but instead, they made him an offer. He was told there was work for him, lucrative work, in a place Interpol would never persuade the local police to arrest and extradite him. One of his bank's largest clients had a need for a personal agent, someone to help her navigate a tricky political and criminal climate, both at home and abroad. And a well-rounded, well-connected operative like Herr Drexler might be able to succeed in this mission quite handily. He was offered the job as the personal action arm of Shakira Al-Azam. He would not be stationed in Europe, which was good news, because Drexler was now persona non grata in Europe, but in Syria itself. If he moved to Damascus to work for the beautiful and powerful First Lady, she would win, the bank would win, and Drexler would win. Well, that was how it was all sold to him, and he leapt at the chance to get out of his dangerous predicament in Switzerland. But he had no idea of the dangers in which he'd find himself in Damascus. Even as a personal agent of a member of the First Family, it was a perilous environment. Syrian President Ahmed Al-Azam himself had to sign off on the plan, and he was agreeable to the idea, for the very simple reason that the 100 million euros in Switzerland at Meyer Privatbank was essentially the last of the money he and his wife had socked away abroad as a hedge against being overthrown at home. If the Swiss bankers who'd managed to hide his loot this long wanted to send a European spy to work full-time, keeping their financial interests protected, then Ahmad knew this would work better than